Hey, hey, Barbara.
Hi.
How are you?
Very good, thanks. It's been a long time, but it's been good.
Yeah. How have your travels been?
Oh, great.
Oh.
garden. It was great.
I don't know how to do it up there. Do you know how to do it?
Where were you?
We went to a lot, and then we crossed over into Jordan and saw Petra.
Oh, how cool. That's really cool. Oh, nice. Yeah. Hi, Susan.
Hey.
Hey, hi, sister.
Hello. I'm back.
I'm glad you're back. Good to have you.
Good.
Okay. How are the other sisters doing?
Oh, well, they're hanging in there. The flu is going crazy around, so.
Oh, yeah, I know. I know. Yeah. Me, like I had this cold, but now it's just the voice. Everything else is okay, but I don't recognize my own voice. What are you going to do?
You actually sound worse this week than you did last week.
Yeah, yeah, but it's all in the voice. I think last week, yeah, was. So there you go. But it is time, so let us get going. We have our third of the three. So we've had If Love Were All and Purim Night and then The Coat. That's the third of this sort of little series of stories about Sonia and Roland. And it's really wonderful to have a series of stories because you can, you know, we can sort of chart the development of their relationship and we can see, you know, some of the development of the individual characters. So it's really nice. So here's number three. And as one of the commentators about Edith Perlman says, it's a beautiful threesome, but it's also each story is sort of perfect in itself, you know, it really can stand on its own. And I think that's true of The Coat too. So, let's begin, 203. Other capitals, began Roland, and paused for breath, as he sometimes did. Sonia waited with apparent serenity. Are in worse shape, he concluded. Hi, Lynn.
Hello.
Other capitals, and we don't know whether he's talking about capital letters or whatever, but we quickly find out that he's talking about Paris because they were standing on the Pont Neuf holding hands. All at once they embraced as if ravaged Paris demanded it. So what does that tell us about Roland that he says other capitals are in worse shape with a breath in between? Well, he's short of breath if he can't get through a sentence without breathing, right? So we have reason to be concerned for his health. And also, but he has this kind of very optimistic, you know, outlook on life. You know, there they are in Paris. You could say, woe is me, look at what happened to the city and so on. And he says, you know, this is not great, but other places are worse. So you can see a little bit of the kind of outlook that he has that allows a person like him to do the work that he has done and continues to do. So what's the Pont Neuf? So that's that bridge in Paris where they put all the locks, you know,
right.
The locks of love, you know, and so on. So it's fitting. First they're holding hands, then they embrace, as if Paris demanded it. Well, that venue sort of suggests it, as it were. Roland Rosenberg was 60 and Sonia Rosenberg was 58. They had directed Camp Grünwasser since 1945, but finally the place has been able to close its last displaced persons repatriated to Romania. So the Rosenbergs too had left, traveling westwards on first one train and then another. Each was dressed in pre-war clothing. Each lugged a single misshapen suitcase. They looked like displaced persons themselves, but their American passports gave them freedom. and their employment by the Joint Distribution Committee gave them cash. Okay, so what do we have in this wonderful visual?
Well, they've sort of grown old together, and they're able now to travel, and right. I mean, they were dressed as though they were sort of displaced persons themselves.
Yeah, they kind of look like the refugees they were taking care of, right? They because each one lugged a single misshapen suitcase. Now, you know, that tells us that a misshapen suitcase also tells us that it's not something that's first on their minds, that their suitcase should have the right shape, or that their clothes should distinguish them as free Americans as opposed to refugees. They're not so much, it's not that not that the material things are unimportant, but you know, they have other concerns. And the Joint has given them cash. Paris was giving them dusty cafes, a few concerts with second-rate performers, black bread, and this old bridge called New. Right, Pont Neuf, the new bridge. Recovering from their embrace, they turned again toward the river. The old world, said Roland, is a corpse. So, I'll finish and then we'll talk. Sonia, who had spent the war years in blistering London and the 5 decades previous in Rhode Island, knew the old world only by reputation. Cafes, galleries, libraries, chamber recitals, salon d'été, polyglots in elegant clothing, conducting afternoon dalliances before returning to one of the great banking houses. A derelict barge sailed toward them, sailed under them. Thin children without shoes played on its deck. Why do they have to recover from their embrace? Well, remember that the embrace was demanded by ravaged Paris. In other words, like they're looking at something and there is a lot of destruction. And so they hold on to each other because it's hard to look at. And so then they recover a little bit. And then they look at the river. And then Roland says, the old world is a corpse. What does he mean by that?
The world as they know it is dead.
I mean, it's gone.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's kind of, in a way, he's stating the obvious, but he's actually stating something that he knows that actually Sonia doesn't know. Because as it says, she knows the old world only by reputation. In other words, like he's saying something that of course is true, but is kind of news to her. You know, because she only knows it from a distance. He's seen Paris before with a capital B, you know, but she had never been out of Rhode Island. So, you know, when he says it, you know, he's saying something that is a, you know, is something that she doesn't have firsthand knowledge of. The old world by reputation. So when we talk about when he says the old world is a corpse, and when she knows by reputation, what is this old world?
A lot of it are the things that made Paris in particular romantic and sort of, I'm not sure what the word I want is, attractive. All of these things of, you know, sitting around at a cafe and chatting and so on and all of that stuff, which is actually, I was going to comment, which is why I think the Pont Neuf is particularly important, because one of the things about that bridge, not only is it one of the oldest bridges, right, but it's also a place where people gather. Yeah. So it's a place, you know, where people sell stuff and, you know, there are prostitutes there, there's this there, there's that there, all kinds of things are happening. It's, you know, people present things there, they speak. So it really is that kind of location in Paris that's, mm-hmm. that in a way is old Paris.
Right. And, you know, it's all of the things that, were true. You know, we usually talk about this in terms of Germany, how, you know, it's amazing that Germany, you know, Beethoven and Brahms and, you know, like all of this high culture of music and all of these, you know, all of this cultured life, that they would be the ones to perpetrate the Holocaust. You know, but, and in Paris, it's not, it doesn't have that resonance, but it does have the sense of, you know, culture and the attack on culture, you know, that, that World War II represented, the attack on so many things. Because Paris also, remember, is a place where, you know, where that's really at the avant-garde in the sense of things that people accept, you know. So even vis-a-vis the Jews, although French has been a, you know, an uneven place for the Jews, but, you know, at least at the beginning, we were going to be included in that liberate, you know, in the French Revolution, we were going to be able to be citizens and so on. So there's a sense of the place that would have been a kind of culture, but also accepting, you know, the cafe culture and art, you know, the galleries and learning, the libraries and music and polyglots. What's a polyglot? Somebody who speaks multiple languages, right? So people of great culture and great education and so on. Now, so part of it is true, and part of it is, you know, what when you have a sense of loss, I don't know how to say this again. It's not that it's mythical, but we tend to give it a resonance that might be more, that might be less nuanced than the actual thing, you know? You know, that this old world, you know, we as Jews, we do that with the shtetl, you know. Jews are very fond of the shtetl, you know, except when we remember that it was abject poverty and, you know, all of the sort of romantic things we think about our ancestors. It, you know, it wasn't quite that sort of golden time for Jewish life, you know, but when we think about it, you know, there's a nostalgia about it, and there's a kind of fond remembering. Now, this old world that is a corpse is, we're going to have, this is the, for Sonia, this is going to be what's symbolized in the coat. The coat is going to be the symbol of that old world and her experience with it. And what happens, like, how does she particularly come to terms with the obliteration of, you know, what was, even if she doesn't have firsthand, you know, she doesn't have the luxury of, you know, remembering that it wasn't as great. You know, she has these ideas, but she never saw it. Okay, on their third day, let's see. Susan, can you read?
Yes.
Yeah.
On the third day, coming out of the brasserie near the Bastille, Roland suffered a heart attack. He spent a week in the hospital. Sonia sat by his side in a long room with metal cots and wooden floors that, like Camp Grusenwasser's infirmary, stank of carbolic acid. She displayed an outward calm. She even felt calm. He would survive the attack, the French doctors told her, with emphasis on the this, but she could not prevent her long fingers from raking her long hair, hair that had turned from gray to white during the war and its aftermath. When Roland was released, they traveled by train to La Havre and by ship to New York. The joint got them a place on Lower Fifth.
Okay. So, Roland, we heard in the first sentence, he's being short of breath. Shortness of breath is one of those symptoms. And sure enough, he has a heart attack. And the doctors say he would survive this attack, right? This attack, emphasis on this, meaning there are more coming and there's going to be one of them that he's not going to survive. And you can see she could not prevent her long fingers from raking her long hair. And this is the second time, in a sense, we've been told that Sonia is kind of calm, right? Because when, you know, she stands with serenity while he's having shortness of breath. And here she is, you know, kind of holding the fort of calm while he's having, you know, while he's just had a heart attack. And she does have a cool, you know, she doesn't lose her cool that much. We saw her a little bit at Camp Gruenwasser losing her cool, but, you know, only after, you know, time after time after time, they can't get the supplies they need. It takes a lot to rattle her. Yeah, just hold on one more second. Yeah, go to the next side of the page, 205, and the third line down, at Camp Gruenwasser.
At Camp Gruenwasser, they had shared an office and then a bedroom. They had married 6 months ago, but they had not yet together made a home.
Okay, so they, you know, first there was the relationship. It was a working relationship. Then it was a romantic relationship. Then they decided to make it official. But they had not yet together made a home. What's the impact? What's the import of that sentence?
They just kept moving. They didn't have their place, mm-hmm. a place that was theirs.
Mm-hmm. There's a sense of disconnectedness about this whole thing that seems to reflect the disconnectedness amongst the people of Europe.
Right. Right. So, you know, they look like displaced persons, and in a sense they are, because, you know, displaced are the people who are not in their place of home, right? And it's not that these, you know, they're not displaced persons in the official sense, but they too had not yet together made a home. They too had not found, as it were, a resting place. Okay, Susan, keep going.
Right away, Sonia got her hair cut. The actress Mary Martin was playing a Navy nurse in a Broadway show. Mary Martin's hair was put close to the scalp, like a boy's. All over Manhattan, women were trying that up Europe, most of them just once. Even the prettiest face looked plain without surrounding fluff. Sonia's long head and steady eyes. "You're always beautiful to me," said Roland when she came nervously home from the beauty shop. The effect of his declaration was stronger because of the flatness of its tone. "I'll love you until the day I die," he added, again without emotion, and she knew that too to be true. "Let the day be slow in coming," she thought, knowing the carbolic of the hospital.
Interesting. So, "let the day be slow in coming," you know, he said, you know, "I will love you to the day I die, yes, but please give us a little bit more time together." Who's Mary Martin, and what's a Mary Martin haircut?
She's Peter Pan.
Right.
Yeah. So, right. So, you know, hair close to the scalp. She also, apparently, one of the reasons that she initially had the close cropping of the hair, at least from what I was reading, I don't know how dependable it is, but she was in South Pacific and she's got to wash that man right out of her hair. And it's easier when your hair is shorter, you know, to wash him, you know, to dry the hair and so on. Yeah. So,
but she also looks great with very short hair.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. She's beautiful. Yes. But again, we have this about Sonia. Her eyes are steady eyes, calm, serenity, you know. She's a rock, our Sonia. Okay, turn to the next page, and where it says they got out in time, said Roland toward the bottom. Page 206.
You want me to keep going?
Yeah. Yeah, they're in the apartment on Lower Fifth Avenue.
"Okay. They got out in time," said Roland. "They're not Jewish. Intellectuals, the liberals. National socialism had no use for them. Which one is our landlady, do you think?" Sonia peered at the faces, alike but different. One wore glasses, one had very full lips. Roland coughed, touched his chin's chest. The curly one, Sonia decided. And so the identity of their more or less landlady, more or less established, they turned to other things. Roland's job at the joint kept him busy. Sonia was playing hop-brow and taking long walks. She got to know the butcher, the grocer, the fishmonger. She was a steady customer at the hardware shop, in the lending library, and the dry cleaning establishment. She patronized the coffee shop on 4th Avenue and established a garret friendship with the proprietors. The joint general and the apprehensive immigrants were kind to him.
Okay, pause there for a second. Thanks. The identity of their more or less landlady, more or less established. So they're looking at pictures and they're kind of playful with each other. You know, who cares really? You know, the joint's paying for the place, but they're just kind of interested in these things and they'll play along together. And then they sort of, you know, and then they conclude and then they move on to other things. It's a sense of the comfort of the couple, you know? They don't have to like get to the bottom of it. More or less, we've got it. Now let's talk about other things. Through the joint, she and Roland met apprehensive immigrants and were kind to them. They may not be running a camp anymore, but it, you know, it was more than running, it was more than a job to them. You know, they're people with a sense of mission and they continue the work even when they're not, you know, even when they're not supposed to be, you know, in any official capacity doing it. They're just kind people. And so, they know the heart of the immigrant, right? They've seen all of this. Okay. And then just finish the paragraph, Susan.
Okay. And so you made two real friends, women who'd known one of her cousins, a jewelry designer on the east side, a social worker on the west. Sometimes on weekends, Sonia and Roland went to the movies with these women and their husbands or out to a restaurant. Normal life, she exulted. She thought of Ida, the camp secretary, maybe safe in Israel, maybe Palestine, maybe killed by mortar fire.
Okay, so so she makes friends, you know, and they go to the movies. And what is the joy in that? Normal life. You know, so because of where they're coming from, you know, she has the kind of appreciation for the small things and the normal things that we try as people who are interested in the spiritual life. We want to always be thankful for those things. And we kind of use our own tools in order to evoke that kind of gratitude. Here, there's nothing to evoke. She is so, you know, there is such gratitude for being able to do the regular things of life when you've been in such a kind, you know, a place of upheaval. But again, Sonia, her mind doesn't stay with her own good fortune. It immediately goes to Ida and knowing that she's in a much more precarious situation. You know, this Arsonia, she might be calm, but she really has a very large heart that is, you know, that holds a lot of people. Okay. The bottom of the page, she opened the left door of the armoire. Lynn, could you take over?
Yeah, I'm looking at it online. So where do you want me to start?
She opened the left door of the armoire.
The left door of the armoire and held the tuxedo high like a lamp. It was shrouded in the new element plastic.
Okay, pause there just for a second, sorry. She held it high like a lamp. It was shrouded in the new element plastic. What's happening there?
Plastic. It's a discovery.
It's new. It's new at this moment. It's shrouded, right? We're looking at the tuxedo that he has to get in order to go to these dinners so that he can tell people to give their money, you know, to displace, you know, to help European refugees. But it's shrouded. You know, for him, the tuxedo is like death. And he says he's going to use it for a shroud later.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Keep going.
She attempted to hang it and encountered resistance. Something was already hanging there. She opened the right door and thrust the tuxedo among the summer clothes. Then she took down the something. It was a long, black, narrow coat of soft wool. It was double-breasted, buttons on the right side, buttonholes on the left, and so she had to look down at her own striped cotton blouse to be sure. It was a coat designed for a man. It had a shawl collar of fur, brown fur, mink probably. Her friend, the jewelry designer, had a mink jacket. Its glossy hair is similar to this. There was a producer who lived on the west on West End Avenue. Sonia had seen him in his famous mink greatcoat. She peeked into the living room. Roland was dozing now, the newspaper in disarray across his lap. She took the coat from the wooden hanger and, carrying it across her two extended arms, brought it into the bedroom.
Okay, there so she put carrying it across in the two extended arms. What is that?
It's a prize.
Yes, yes, it's a, you know, it's, you know, with great reverence, she's carrying this coat. Okay.
There she put it on. The stripes of her blouse peeped between the crescents of fur like some other species. This coat needed a brandy-colored silk scarf costing perhaps 1 month of Roland's salary, perhaps two. A bit of black would suffice. She reached into her middle drawer, pulled out a black slip, draped it within the collar, there. Women's slacks were just catching on. They were not generally for street wear unless the streets were in the village. Sonia had adopted them enthusiastically. They suited her long stride. She could buy men's pants off the rack. She was wearing black trousers today and Oxfords. A pier glass stood between the two bedroom windows. She walked slowly toward it. What a distinguished gentleman. How well the white-haired head sat above the fur collar. The owner of this coat must be a slender fellow. The garment barely skimmed Sonia's thin frame. A man like this had had the cash to get out of Vienna, then get out of Paris, then get to New York. Not like the little shoemaker Yankel and his numerous children. Not like the chess-playing Claude, smoking and coughing on his lower bunk.
Okay, just one more.
She took off the coat and brought it into the living room. Roland was awake. She showed him the garment like a sales lady, displaying the fine workmanship of the button right cuff. The other cuff, she discovered, had lost its button.
Okay, so what is it about this coat that is so intriguing to Sonia?
It's beautiful.
Okay, it's a beautiful piece of clothing. Yeah.
Unlike anything she's seen recently.
Right. Right. She's buying pants off the rack, you know, and what she's seen people, you know, who she's encountered in have been, you know, different kinds of rags and so on. And here's this coat with fur and, you know, and the texture of the wool is, you know, it's soft wool. And we're going to hear a little bit later about the lining that you can touch, and it almost feels alive. It's a kind of, she who's not an expert in clothing, has a sense that this is something that somebody took very great care in making, and that you had to have a certain amount of means in order to be able to buy it. So as she says, this is not Yankel with his kids. This is, you know, somebody who was able to escape the war because they could. And the detail, you know, the buttoned right cuff. And so she's taken with it. There's something about it that really is taking her. So she becomes the sales lady to Roland, right? okay, let's keep going. So at the bottom of the page, oh, your first guess must have been right. She turned from the coat and walked back to Roland. The pictures of that pretty family were taken by the coat's owner, our landlord, the beloved young uncle. No longer young, he sighed, still beloved, and she touched his arm. Amazing, really amazing. So they've returned to the conversation about who's the landlord. Pick him out in the pictures. So now it's changed because of the coat. And so must be the person who took the pictures. And then she goes into her playful, the beloved young uncle. She has no clue, of course, right? The beloved young uncle. And then what was, you know, a kind of playful suggestion on her part becomes an expression of love between the two of them. He says, no longer young, meaning me. And she says, I love you anyway, I don't care. You know, it's just such a tender, beautiful moment. Okay, turn to the next page, 210. And let's see, sister, would you like to read?
Took the coach to the neighborhood yarn shop, its missing button preyed on her conscience like a hungry pet. Can you match this? Sonia handed the buttoned right sleeve to the woman on the other side of the counter. The rest of the coat remained in her protective embrace. Ah, you don't need such buttons anymore. May I see the others? Without waiting for permission, the woman leaned forward and grasped the coat under the arms and took it from Sonia and laid it on the counter. She examined the carved leather hemispheres on the breast. She raised little green eyes to Sonia's. We have nothing like this here. I would not know where to look, though in Budapest, and she trailed off sentimentally, but maybe. She thrust her ring hand into the coat's pocket, a pocket that Sonia had not guessed was there. So flat it was, so cleverly disguised by the sea. Ah, she said again, I knew it was loose, ripped it off, kept it safe. Who? Your employer. Sonia had pulled on an old cardigan sweater against the October chill. She supposed she did look like a housekeeper. A tailor should sew this on. Don't try it yourself. The tailor on University Place did the job well while she waited. A sudden wind swept newspapers against the shop's grimy window. Once outside, Sonia noticed that the temperature had dropped, so she put on the coat.
Okay, so just 1 second. She's gonna, so there's a button missing. She takes it to the yarn shop and she wants to match it, you know, because that's what is due to the coat. You know, you don't just put on any button. You've got to, you know, and she has this sense about the coat. The rest of the coat remained in her protective embrace. She's, you know, why is she so protected? Why her protective embrace? She has feelings about this coat that make it more than a coat for her.
But so does the yarn shop.
Yes.
I mean, she says, you don't make such buttons anymore.
Right, right. So, and we
I like that.
And what is the ach? What's the ach?
She's saying it with regret, you know, you don't meet buttons like this.
Right, and also probably she's an immigrant, right?
The coat is symbolic of the old world. It's what was and what yes. will be again.
Exactly.
Yes, you don't meet such buttons. Beautiful. May I see the others? But then she leaned forward and grasps the coat under the arms. Look at that visual. It's like you're picking up a person, right? Who would ever, you know, you would grasp, if it's like a regular coat, you grasp it by the shoulder. You know, you take the top of the coat and you take it toward you. But no, this coat, both for Sonia and for the shop, she's taking it under the arms like you would lift up a person. And she examined the carved leather hemispheres on the breast. She's treating it like one would, you know, that carefulness, like with some kind of living presence. But then it's cold, she puts on the coat. Okay, top of the next page, 211. The next afternoon, it kept her company. Sister, do you want to continue?
Okay. The next afternoon, it kept her company in the kitchen while she cooked. Another afternoon, while she lay on the bed reading, the coat slumped on a rosé chassis. She did not wear it again until after the Christmas holidays. Then there was a cold snap. Her own coat was warm, yes, but would not the old gentleman's be warmer still? Its lining, unseen between silk and wool, was light yet effective. When she held the fabric between thumb and fingers, something slid within as if alive. She bought it a scarf, not real silk, something synthetic. All these new fabrics, The color was perfect, cognac. She bought cashmere-lined leather gloves on sale. In a thrift shop, she found a hat in the shape of a squat cylinder, mink-dyed squirrel.
Okay, so let's pause here for a second. Notice the language now, talking about the coat, right? The coat keeps her company. Coat keeps her company. The coat slumps. There was one more when she held the fabric. Oh, she bought it a scarf, as if it, she's buying it for the coat. What is going on here? So she is trying to, in a sense, she's trying to fix the coat. You know, the coat was kind of broken and the coat didn't have maybe the scarf that would accompany it. And she's trying to kind of bring the coat back to its former glory, as it were. And so she treats it the way, the way it should be treated. Okay, next page, 212, the second paragraph. Barbara, do you want to read? She did not think of the coat as lawfully hers. Oh, no.
Yeah, sure. She did not think of the coat as lawfully hers. Oh, no. But in its illicit protection, she became a personage. Immigrant men hoping to adapt to the new world were buying fedoras and secondhand broad-shouldered suits. Unwittingly, they looked like gangsters. In print dresses, their wives resembled charladies. Sonia, American by birth, graduate of the teacher's college and an accounting course, never out of the country until she was past 50. Sonia was preserving the old world of ringed dresses, universities, coffee houses, salons, museums, bunts and diets, and parliaments and banks. She walked and walked. Truck drivers shouted coarse phrases to one another. Shop girls out for lunch wore glistening lipstick. Sometimes she paused at a department store window and bowed at her reflection.
Bowed at her reflection. She was preserving the old world of Ringstrasse's. They're all buying the new stuff, right? But she wears the coat because even though it's not hers, in its illicit protection, she becomes a personage. You know, people who are going for the new stuff, they look like gangsters. But she, in the old coat, you know, there's a character there. And so she bows at her reflection. This coat to her represents, you know, sort of the nobility and the good and the, you know, the finer things in life of what was before. Okay. So then she goes to this concert in this school, top of the next page, 213. Your grandchild is performing, said the person next to her, a hammered page boy under a beret, a badly reconstructed nose. Okay. This is somebody also of means. A badly reconstructed nose costs something, right? Yes, she will dance, slightly friendly. What is her name? Slightly interested. She is my daughter's child, said the Baron Sonia. My name is. But of course, the woman's not interested in her name. Why is she not interested in her name?
Because she's focused on the kids and she's not interested in anything but what's going on in front of her.
Right. And her, with her nose and everything, she's a person of the new world. And she might be a little competitive, you know, because her kid versus my kid. But once, you know, she hears that it's a grandchild, Sonia's neighbor turned her worshipful gaze toward the headmaster. And she can't even get the last word out. This woman has scurried away so fast. Grünwasser, right? My name is Grünwasser. Because this woman really has no interest in her at all. But the woman was no longer listening. Who wanted to listen to a refugee from God knows where, right? Delicate voices on the stage were singing Stephen Foster. The children's chorus at the camp had managed Berlioz. Well, they'd been directed by a once notable baritone from Dresden. He was in Argentina now. She wondered how he was faring among the gauchos. So, you know, she's in New York and she's in a different place, but her, but part of her is still, you know, back with the people that she knew, you know, the children's chorus. They had like a real musician leading that chorus, like somebody of note, you know, as opposed to this kind of new, and it's supposed to be, you know, so impressive and so on. But, you know, there's the substance and the weightiness and the gravitas versus the new and the, you know, trendy and so on, being contrasted here. She stepped away from, oh, but then she gets the call about Roland. She stepped away from the fallen coat, kicked it, got the room number, hung up, grabbed her raincoat from the closet. Really, spring had come at last, and retrieved wallet and keys from the table. Okay, so she's been in a kind of reverie about the world that was, and she has been startled, jarred, awakened terribly into the present. Roland is having another heart attack. So go to 215. He survived, thank God, he survives the heart attack. And now we come to the end. 215 at the bottom. Oh yes, the coat, right? The person whose apartment they rented, the landlord, apparently they did such nice things for this landlord that she wants to meet them. And she meets them, and, you know, I don't know what she was expecting, but the truth is that she's not so much interested in them once she meets them, or once she sees them, perhaps. But he had left his tuxedo there, and it was hiding behind Franz's old coat. Oh, yes, the coat, said Sonia. So she hadn't taken it, of course. My ex-husband, I kept it out of malice. He loved it so. I think I'll give it to the writers and artists thrift shop. Our organization distributes clothing to the needy. You know, she's trying without asking for it. I'll take it. I'll remember that, said Erica. She'd forget it before the elevator reached the lobby. She doesn't want to, you know, despite the fact that they gave her, you know, plenty, she's not that kind of person. Okay. I'll remember that, and she's going to forget it. On the sidewalk, Roland pointed to the tuxedo, which Sonia carried over her arm. I'll never wear that thing again. Who knows, with proper care, you can live another 20 years, quoting his doctor. Proper care does not include after-dinner speeches in a monkey suit. Yes, well, and the coat. The tuxedo will do for a shroud. The coat. Her mind is, you know, not on the tuxedo, it's on the coat. She would haunt the writers and artists thrift shop until the thing appeared. She's not going to let that coat go. She's going to go every single day to see if she can find that coat. She'd buy it and stash it in the finished chest. Maybe in that relic, the old world would find repose. Maybe in that relic, the old world would find repose. With Sonia, what she's looking to this coat, she has to find some way of making peace between past and present, right? And there's something of her that's longing and wishing and wish there wasn't all of this loss and everything. And that's sort of embodied by the coat. And if not, let it writhe. Let, you know, the coat is alive. So let it, okay, maybe it won't find repose. Maybe it'll just have to like continue. Love. A shroud up yours, snorted Sonia. What brings her back into the present is that by comparison, the love of a living, breathing human being who's here, you know, and she says, up yours, snorted Sonia, startling him, making him smile. I intend to keep you around, darling. Darling, let's have dinner out. In other words, she's kind of pulled toward the past, but then she comes back into the present with a vengeance because she remembers that life is short. Really, that's, you know, that's what the lesson of the fact that there was an old world, that's what, you know, she knew and she had to relearn yet again, which was, you know, life is right here, right now. And she has this beloved person right with her. Let's have dinner out. you know, celebrating the moment right now. She took his arm and led him to a new Italian place on East 12th, one which the courtly old gentleman in the fur-collared coat had never had a chance to patronize. So, you know, the land of the living versus what seems to be this beautiful past and distinguished gentleman and so on. You know, there's really no choice between them, right? We can patronize this new restaurant. You know, as beautiful as the coat is, that man didn't have time to whenever he had the chance. But we're going to seize the moment now, and we're going to eat and drink and be merry, right? Because, you know, we don't know what tomorrow will be. So the life that she has, the precious life that she has, Roland, is available to her here and now. And so she's going to re-put herself back into the present and leave the lost world, you know, behind to a certain extent. So thoughts about this story.
I love her relationship with the coat. I think it's just wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And what about it?
Well, the coat represents so many things to her. First of all, it's luxurious. Yeah. So it's the kind of thing that she really has not had an opportunity to touch and to hold and to have for a very, very long time. Right. Second, it represents the sort of what we've lost in the war. Yeah. And everything that goes with that. And third, it represents, you know, sort of like coming back from this horror that, you know, she'd been through with the refugee camps and everything else. So it's this thing that represents hope, and yet it represents what we've lost, and it's something that she can't give up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, she needs it.
Mm-hmm. And she has a sense of obligation to it, in the sense to the coat itself, but to what the coat represents. Mm-hmm. She wants it to find repose. She wants, you know, she wants to put something to rest, you know, if that is at all possible, which it's not really, but, you know, wouldn't it be nice if we could give the old world a little bit of rest, you know, that it deserves. Go ahead.
And I was just going to say, and even just the whole thing with the button and all of that is just shows how much she is concerned for it and cares for it, how important it's become to her.
Yeah. And the woman in the shop, she knows to look in the pocket, right? Because if mm-hmm. this was somebody, you know, and if that person at all cared about good workmanship and so on, right. He would make sure that it could be sewn back on.
Yeah.
And so there's something there also, which is, you know, can we fix the coat? Can we, you know, bring it back in some way? Because, you know, that's what we would like to do to the whole mess of the whole thing, you know. Is there some way we can fix it? No, of course not. But, you know, but it doesn't mean we don't try a little bit. And it doesn't mean that even though we don't live in the past, that we don't have that kind of reverence for things that represent the past to us. Who would think, except somebody with an unbelievable imagination? You know, and then there are the regular details that Edith Perlman does so well. I don't know how you pronounce it, but did you guys know what a Biedermeier sofa is?
Yes.
You know what it was. It's one of those, you know, they have these kind of, I don't know, how would you describe it? You should look it up afterwards. It's a very particular kind of sofa from a very, you know, specific moment, but one that's very... my great aunt had one of those sofas. So when I looked at it and I saw it, I thought, oh, there's Aunt Dora's sofa, you know? It's a very it's a very luxurious. Many of them were very luxurious pieces, but there are also pieces where you can see the workmanship, both in the wood and in you know, some of the not embroidery, but some of the needlework that would go into the stitching of a piece.
Well, the Biedermeier furniture is associated with that period of time when the middle class just began to arise,
uh-huh.
You know, and they were taken with arts and so on and so forth, and so that they went for these things.
Yeah, access to the finer things, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, the finer things in life. Beautiful. So, you know, so what do we have when at the end of this threesome? You know, we have a kind of, we have as most of the time, Edith Perlman leaves off a story and you don't really know what's going to happen afterwards. But because we've had the three stories, this ending, actually, we know what's going to happen. They're going to live as closely and as wonderfully as they can for however long Roland has. And, you know, and whatever time they have together will be beautiful and full of love. And, you know, because that's all that matters, really, you know, the beloveds in our lives. So kind of cool. So anyway, that's all I had to say. Any other thoughts, questions, comments?
I think it's like we all have to struggle with the past and the present.
Yes.
Like, oh, those were the good old days, but then it's like,
yes,
she comes to the present. And
yes.
Nice and she comes back, okay, we have to do this, go eat dinner, and, you know, what was is in the past.
This
is Karen. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Hi, Karen.
Yeah. Hi. Yeah, I was just... also, like the context in which we live, the past, the present, you know, just has a lot of impact on our experience.
Yeah.
I'm reminded, you know, like the Nouveau Riche and what was going on there and what she was grabbing onto, and it's, yeah, we're impacted.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, with the coat, it's almost as if the past has a claim on her. She's drawn, you know, there's something hugging her. You know, what Karen's saying about the context, you know, we all have those things in our lives that a lot of times we might not even be conscious of until there's a moment of longing and we realize, uh-oh, there's something going on there. Where did that come from? You know, and for her, it's the coat.
Yeah, and we can't not have those things.
Yes.
That's just part of our experience.
Yes. Yeah. And a rich one, you know, kind of, you know, sort of reminds us who we are and, you know, parts of where we've come from and our experience and so on. You know, makes us, it's sort of evidence that we have a very rich emotional makeup that came from other places and so on. Sometimes we're conscious of, sometimes not. Beautiful. All right, my friends, onward to the next one.
So we're not meeting next week, right?
We're not meeting next week, so 2 weeks from today.
I won't be here. I'll be in the hospital.
Okay.
Hopefully with a new shoulder.
Oh, please God, please God. We'll be thinking of you, and I'll record it, so no worries.
Okay.
Lynn, good luck.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.